time expire.
We'll move on to our next case, Ramirez-Garay v. Holder. Mr. Gambacorta.
Good morning. May it please the court, there are three questions of law that have to be addressed this morning. The first issue is on whether the BIA and the immigration judge failed to follow case precedent in interpreting exceptional and extremely unusual hardship. In this case, we have a trilogy of three cases on Monreal, Andaza, and Bacinas. The immigration judge based his denial of petitioner's cancellation of removal based on the failure to put forth adequate medical hardship. And in fact, the immigration judge introduced evidence on behalf of the government. Undersigned counsel has ever seen a judge introduce evidence on behalf of the government.
And what evidence did the judge
Medical reports to contradict my findings. I had submitted a letter by the doctor.
These were internet sites that he visited, WebMed,
right.
And some other one.
To see
how these conditions are treated.
Right. If the government had introduced the evidence, that's one thing. But for a person who wears the black robe, you can't do that.
I wear a black robe.
Well, okay.
I don't know why an administrative officer can't look at the. Was this Mayo Clinic or?
Correct. Yes.
It's perfectly reputable, right? What's wrong with consulting the Mayo Clinic? I don't get that.
It's just general literature, isn't it? Defining what the disease is about and that sort of thing.
Correct.
It's not anything specific about him or anyone else.
Yeah. Correct. And the IJ, he based his denial on the fact that the medical condition is common among adolescents. I don't know how he made the finding. My second argument is the IJ also failed to consider country conditions when he made his.
Look, we're seeing a lot of this. Of course, Mexico has a crime problem, but does that mean no one can be deported to Mexico?
No, but the exact town where the respondent is from, there is a lot of drug violence, and I even put the respondent on the stand, and he told us about what happens in his town.
Well, is he in the drug business?
He is not.
Well, who are the victims of this drug violence? Suppose that if you subtracted drug crimes and violence between gangs, within gangs, and so on. Suppose you subtracted that on the theory that this person is not part of the drug business, which is very dangerous. Then would Mexican crime rates be so astronomical?
Well, you don't have to be a part of the cartel to be murdered. I mean, it can be anyone. It can be.
Well, how common? Yes, bystanders can be injured, but how common is that?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Well, suppose they bomb a party where there's a lot of people attending, many of them in that business, but maybe there were some others. I guess they'd call that collateral damage or something. It's awful, no question about it. But as Judge Posner says, this doesn't mean nobody has to go back to Mexico. There are places you can go that are, I assume, less violent.
And I concur with that, but the IJ didn't put that in his undecision. He never made a finding on that. And that's why I'm here today.
What's odd about this focus on drug violence in Mexico, of course, our media love violence anywhere in the world. The more grotesque, the more entertaining, right? What's odd about it is, first, that Mexico is doing very well economically, number one. Number two, the immigration from Mexico to the United States has fallen substantially, and a lot of Mexicans in the United States are returning voluntarily. So, while there's certainly violence in particular areas associated with heavy drug activity, it's not clear that people, that Mexicans in general, who are not involved in either, who are not part of the police, not part of drug gangs, not drug addicts, consumers, are in any greater danger than they are in Texas, which has the highest crime rate in the United States.
Right? Okay. Okay. And my final argument is a issue that I haven't really seen yet, and it's on whether an IJ's failure to give the proper voluntary departure advisals.
He's not eligible, right?
Well, no, but back then, correct, he was eligible. But when you file a petition, it cuts off the voluntary departure anyway. But
he had certain time frames to do certain things and didn't.
Right, right. And, you know,
I think he got it back after he'd already lost it. He got it back once.
Correct. I mean,
yeah, he posted the bond, so he got the, he got the benefit.
Well, that's because of me, because I know the rules, but...
Right.
If
so
if
the warnings, the warnings were that he didn't get were about things that adverse things that would have happened to him that couldn't have happened since he posted the bond. It's hard to see how that's harmful.
That would make little sense, because then would that encourage someone to not post the bond so the case could be remanded?
So he wants the chance to go back and not post the bond and be deported involuntarily?
He wants the case remanded. Now, there is no prejudice here. I argue it's presumed. I mean, I'm the one that did the research and I posted the bond, right? But assume for arguendo he had an attorney who did not post the bond. He would be in a better position then.
The better position to argue that argument, I think, if he posted the bond, he's not at all harmed by the failure to give those warnings.
Well, then you're penalizing...
Being a good lawyer, huh?
You're penalizing someone who follows the law to post the bond.
How are you penalizing? Because if he didn't post the bond, then he gets deported involuntarily. He doesn't get to voluntarily depart.
Well...
He's not penalized at all.
Could I argue that if the case was remanded, possibly he could partake in prosecutorial discretion, because that would be open if you're in proceedings. But that's for another day. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Gambacorta. Mr. Hayes?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Timothy Hayes on behalf of the Attorney General. I'll go in order of the three questions that my colleague presented. The first having to do with the Mayo Clinic and the WebMD report that the immigration judge submitted. The issue is waived because it wasn't raised in his opening brief. But even if it wasn't waived, the board explained that it was there to provide background evidence of the conditions. Mr. Ramirez has a burden of proof on the cancellation application, and outside of a couple of medical letters from the physicians that treated his children, he didn't provide any information about the conditions in general, so the judge was unaware of what it even really was. And this was a way for the judge to figure out the background evidence of the conditions. The second point on that is the judge explicitly asked Mr. Ramirez's attorney whether he objected to the judge entering this evidence into the record, and his attorney said he did not. As for the country conditions evidence, the immigration judge considered that at page 4 and page 8 of his decision, which is Administrative Record 77 and 81, note 3, and he acknowledged that conditions are violent in Mexico. As far as the finding issue, he did say that the children, that Mr. Ramirez argued that the children might not be able to receive the same medical care in Mexico as they do in the United States, but that he didn't provide any evidence that he couldn't relocate in Mexico to a part of the state or country that had appropriate medical treatment for his children. The finding was basically a dearth of evidence, which he bears a burden of showing.
Just as an internal question, is this a common complaint now for people being deported to Mexico? Is this something that's brought up all the time about the violence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a common response to that?
As from my experience, it comes up a lot in the Ninth Circuit, and that court denies it routinely on summary affirmance motions.
Okay.
And the third issue has to do with the voluntary departure advisals. The board outright conceded that the immigration judge overlooked that. He did not provide the oral advisals. There are a couple points with that. First, Mr. Ramirez, as Judge Posner pointed out, is no longer a voluntary departure recipient. His filing of this petition for review rescinded the grant. And my understanding is he has not departed the country, so even though there's a regulatory safe hatch where you can still receive the benefits if you leave after filing your petition, he will not receive the benefits of voluntary departure. The flip side is there's no negatives to it. He's not subject to the 10-year bar to discretionary relief from removal, and he's not subject to a civil penalty. The second point is he would never, ever receive voluntary departure again under 8 U.S.C. 1229C subparagraph C, because if you receive it initially and you've conceded that you've entered the country without inspection or admission, you're not eligible for voluntary departure again. So the issue is mooted. And unless Your Honors have any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Mr. Gamacorda, do you have anything further?
I just wanted to address the fact that I couldn't. Counsel is correct. I do not object to the IJ's introduction of evidence because how can I say I'm no to a judge like that? If it was opposing party, of course I would.
Well, it wasn't harmful anyway. All it does is tell you what the disease is about. Is that?
Well, correct.
Why would you object?
Because the judge should be an impartial fact finder.
Well, you may have easily submitted the same stuff.
Do you contest what he?
I don't contest it. I just
what's
like
the prejudice. Then,
I believe that's the government's job is to introduce the evidence. I mean, I don't believe in it.
I don't think you're right. Administrative law judges are not anywhere as passive as trial judges are.
That's correct.
They're constantly they usually do more questioning of the alien than the Department of Homeland Security lawyer does.
Correct.
You're imposing some model of federal judicial procedure on an administrative agency. Allowed to do that. Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you to...